Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm Stu Iffin, I'm your host. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode, well, it's a rather lovely episode. I got to sit down with somebody that I've known, for probably fast approaching 20 years. And I've watched his career in music grow and grow. And so it was really nice to sit down and chew the fat. And my guest is Luke Branch, frontman of Asylums and one of the owners of Cool Thing Records. And we discuss all of this amongst all the other usual stuff, school, growing up, clubbing, creative journey, etc., etc. But before we get on with it, I just want to say thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. Thank you to Scribbius Pip and everybody over at the Distraction Pieces Network. And if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then go and have a rummage in the archives, because you'll find up to 150 episodes of pod chats with some incredible musicians, actors, comedians, DJs, producers. One of Luke's bandmates, Mike Webster. That's another great chat worth visiting. And if that's not enough for you, then I also have a Patreon page where I put a standalone episode up each week over there. You can find out about all of this off the beatentrackpodcast.com. I'm going to stop with this intro business now and get on with the podcast. So please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Luke Branch of Asylums. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing, www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music, and they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. Welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. Joining me today, about 25 miles up the road from here, but we're doing this in lockdown over the means of Zoom, is Luke from Asylums. Hello.
Hello there, mate. Thanks for having us.
Sorry, Luke Branch, really. I shouldn't just call you Luke from Asylums. You're your own entity as well, aren't you, mate?
Yes, I come from a long line of crazy people with the Branch surname.
Wonderful. How you been?
It's been an interesting period. That's an understatement. I'm a habitual watcher, really, man. So I do my music work. I do some of my day job bits and pieces, and then I just spend time with my family. I've got a 6-month-old at home, so it's been a very different period for me. But I'm grateful in some ways to have had some extra time to spend with my my son. So because it's a juggling extravaganza at the best of times, but on the kind of flip of that, it's been a sort of dark and very depressing time in some ways, and then in other ways there's some inspirational stuff happening, so it's a mixture of emotions for me, man.
I think that's the case. I've been asking every guest that I've had on during lockdown about this and how it's affected them, you know, not just as a human, but, you know, as a creative as well. And, you know, lots of people have kind of instantly gone back with, you know, when we was told we was going to be housebound, that was it. I just thought, right, I'm going to write an album. I'm going to do this. But they said quite quickly that kind of knee-jerk response of I'm going to do that also was met with a complete creative lull and no kind of fire in their belly to do it.
Right.
And it said it took a few weeks, which I think seems, you know, I mean, I'd be curious to know how it affected you, because I think everybody just, whatever, you know, whoever you are, like when you're told you can't leave your house and there's something that none of us have ever experienced before, I think nobody knew what to do. So I think everybody, some of us sort of went into like a bit of a holiday mode and it was like, well, I'll have a beer tonight and stuff like that. But I do think it took a few weeks for people to just slightly kind of get their head around what was going on and sort of settle into a routine. How was it for you?
I was out and about the last day before lockdown, and we were working on some stuff for the album actually with a video maker, and then like the kind of, I think the press conference where they talked about the furloughing scheme for the first time, that all happened, and we were kind of, I think it was a Friday, maybe that was several days before the actual lockdown, and I just kind of I was processing it. I wasn't saying a lot, and I just kind of came home. And I have a little kind of office in my back garden, which I had done when the baby was born. And I just went out there and painted it white, and then ordered some soundproofing, did that, moved all my musical equipment out here, which is very modest, to say the least, old school 8-track acoustic guitar, keyboard from Argos, and, you know, a few bits, a few other bits and bobs, and 808, which is probably my most favorite thing. But I write every day anyway, so I thought, well, I'm probably going to go mad if I don't write, because I can't perform. Yeah. But yeah, like I say, I've always been an everyday writer. I do it for mental health reasons as much as anything else, and just a pure escapism, just good old fashioned. Like, you know, I'm not thinking, I'm just creating. So on that level, I kind of enjoyed building my little, you know, kind of TARDIS out in the back garden. But it took me, I would say, at least, you know, five or so weeks to start making sense of the world and what was even happening, you know, and what it meant for me as an individual and for the people that I knew, as you know, as the music industry came under more and more strain to be able to develop ways to survive, as we all were as performers, but then people behind the scenes, from sound engineers to tour managers and all the rest of it. So there was that going on. And then just like huge admiration for the people that, you know, working for the NHS and caregivers and stuff, and just sort of, you know, I've always had a lot of love, because when I was very young, I was ill with meningitis and they saved my life, you know. And so it's not something that, you know, it's something super, super sincere, as I'm sure it's for everybody that claps and what have you. But for me, it's personal as well. It's, you know, and then just having had the baby, we had a really difficult kind of time, and we were in hospital for a week, and they were just, you know, just total, you know, heroes and heroines. Yeah. So, a bit of a long way around to say it's been emotional. It's not been without good moments. It's been, like I say, with my son and writing and developing interesting ways to communicate with people on the label that we run and our own band. But we are promoting a record through this time, which is almost a culmination of almost a life's work, you know. So it's a lot of mental balancing and what have you.
Well, we'll definitely talk about the album and the band and what's going on as this podcast unfolds. But I always like to kick off the chat, Luke, with track one, which is what you think is the song with the greatest ever intro.
That is a hard question. There's so many great.
They're meant to be hard, Luke.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah, there's so many great candidates running through my mind, but I thought I'd just go with the absolute truth of when I was a little egg getting into music, and I just heard the first chords of In Utero roar out, and I was like, "That sounds like the way I feel every day." And it just busted into that riff, and probably one of the coolest opening lines of a record ever.
And the track being
"Serve the Servants,"
Luke. Last week I had Justin from Editors and Minor Victories on the podcast. He chose that as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, and like a lot of people would kind of will always go, well, you know, I thought about Teen Spirit, but swerved it, and when he sent his tracks over, I went back and listened to In Utero.
Yeah,
and that track, which I also said to Justin when he mentioned it, it's fucking insane, isn't it? It's almost metal. It's like, it's just fucking huge, isn't it?
I think I don't know whether this is just my kind of assumption, but there's almost a sort of early Beatles-esque quality to the drumming. I mean, it's on the ride cymbal in the verse, which is very Ringo, but really, I think the bits of the song that really connect with me, I mean, they're a great band. Of course, they're a great band, but it's the level of sarcasm, disdain, emotional turmoil in the lyrics. And that solo, man, that solo is just next level crazy. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, no wave music inside pop music. So super cool. And it's just so direct and simple at its core. But it's super intelligent as well. So it really appeals to me that.
And obviously it must have made a dent sonically, because am I right that the new album's produced by Steve Albini?
It is. And, you know, there's so many great records that that guy has made. I wouldn't want to reduce him down to just the record that he made with Nirvana or anything like that. But that was like a big, you know, when I was growing up, we only had Woolworths in where I lived, and there was no record shops, you know. So if it wasn't, you know, coming through the mainstream until I was about 15, I wouldn't hear it, you know, maybe a little bit younger, 14 or something, but definitely around 12, 13. And I had to be able to get hold of like those records in Woolworths. And I remember like kind of picking that up years after it had come out. It wasn't lots of time, but it was a good few years after it had actually been released, and it kind of turned me on to first things like the Blue Album by Weezer. But then as I kind of got older, I started to discover all this great stuff that Albini had done, which kind of gave me a sort of, you know, underground American history lesson. And, you know, everything from like Slint through to sort of like, you know, unreleased albums that we were like Fugazi and Big Black, his own bands like Shellac. And it just, you know, I think it, more than anything, it was a super inspirational and fertile time, that 80s into 90s underground American scene that he was so affiliated with. And, you know, and then some great British stuff, you know, PJ Harvey.
Okay. For track two, Luke, I want to know what the first song was that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So my mum used to teach aerobics and, kind of very, very intimidating for a young boy to be carried along to an aerobics lesson because they couldn't find a babysitter. And my parents were very young. My mum, you know, I think they had me when like 22 or something, you know, so she was still a young woman when I was going there. And like, and, you know, it was a, you know, I couldn't say it was sexy. I didn't know what that was all about at that point. But I remember on one particular evening, she was listening to Sign of the Times, the whole album, on the way to aerobics, and we were early, which is classic my mum, because she's got ants in her pants, man. She's always trying to get out the door, and we just sat and just listened to it, and I suddenly heard it as it was intended to be listened to, rather than just like background music for a kid. And I said, Mum, what's this song about? Because there's all the, you know, when a rocket ship explodes, and everybody still wants to fly, man ain't happy till man truly dies. And it's just like, I mean, when you're like eight, there's some pretty existential stuff going on in that song.
It still felt like that when I was 18 when I heard it, man.
I'm sure it just crosses everything, you know. I mean, that first verse, you know, in Paris, a skinny man dies of a big disease with a little name. And I think, you know, musically, it's absolutely just got this hollowed out space to it, which really, really sounds as detached as the lyrics come across. And then, you know, kind of, it got me questioning the world. And that was the first song that I'd ever done that. And trying to understand the world that I was growing up in, which was, you know, I was in, you know, a very small town in Essex called Hadley, which didn't have anything but car showrooms in it. And all of a sudden you're thinking about kind of nuclear war and kind of the ceiling being torn off churches and AIDS and heroin and crack and all these things that were going on in the world, really, really kind of distressing things. And then it's just there on this record by this guy that's widely regarded as a sex symbol, with the sexiest of the sexy. But, you know, inside that brain was a lot of amazing stuff, as everybody knows. So I was totally inspired by it, you know.
And so that emotion would have been what?
Well, I have good days and bad days, and I think it tapped into the feelings that I have on bad days. You know, which is kind of like just detachment and just, and even the sound of it just sounds like that, you know, that kind of throbbing, almost kind of heartbeat running through it on the kick and the snare and no chords really, you know, just totally skeletal. And then, so the words are up front and center. And I think it just, I don't know, when I'm having a bad time, which, you know, is less these days, but, there's certain kinds of music that resonates with me in that way. And that was probably the first one that I can remember that did it, that kind of spoke to that part of me.
Are you comfortable, like when you're having like a day where you're feeling low, do you reach for some, you know, I'm not saying S Club 7, but do you reach for something positive and up, or are you happy to kind of immerse yourself in that feeling and soundtrack it with music that kind of aids that?
I think as I've got older, I've learned how to manage those kind of things. I think they're very common with creative people, but not just creative people. And I think, you know, there were probably years where I, you know, would sit listening to Joy Division until my ears fell off, but then there were, you know, I use meditation, you know, meditation twice a day. That's a good stabilizing force in my life, and making music is, and performances. And I think, you know, the performer in me is the opposite, you know, of that kind of, that kind of part of me. So I kind of tried to balance myself out by going crazy and running around stage sometimes. And then I'll sit and think about words endlessly in a darkened room, as you'd expect.
Wonderful. So for track three, Luke, the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Oh, wow. This was a hard one to pick, you know, because when I was at secondary school specifically, like that's where I just got so into music then I would move on really quickly, you know. I was a mod for a while, you know, and I was into like kind of, you know, grunge and, you know, you know, Britpop, and then I, towards, you know, the end, I was getting into, you know, kind of electronic music. So, so it was hard to whittle it down, but I, one thing kind of, as when you ask the question like that, you know, kind of, normally a memory occurs, right? And I think, you know, kind of, I just remember going to see my friend Leon, on a Saturday, I think in the summer holidays, which are just glorious anyway, but, he was rehearsing with a band, which contained another one of my best friends, and they were playing so loud, that like they couldn't hear me. And so I just thought, oh, sorry, I'll just go and sit and chill out by the book. And I just listened to them rehearse for about 15 minutes, and they played Richard III. And I'd always loved it. But I think at that moment I was like, I think I want to be a musician. Because it just sounded like the greatest time they were having in there. You know, it's full of energy and life. And then, you know, nothing really speaks to me lyrically on that song or anything. That one's just pure adrenaline. Just
it thunders, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's just, and it sounds like three brains, or maybe four brains, you know, kind of working in perfectly complementing each other. And it's a really sophisticated arrangement. It's all sorts of reasons to love it. Yeah. But when it comes down to the crunch, that opening riff just blows my head off. And it just reminds me of whatever that summer was. I can't remember what year it would have been. But it just, you know, the doors come off, man, and it's powerful. And I had the good fortune of meeting Danny Goffey a couple of years ago. We played a show for him at his house. And it was called, I think Goftonbury after Danny Goffey, you know. So, but you know, that was kind of a weird thing, you know, when you get older and you start to meet people that have been quite inspirational to you in your younger years. And I was totally starstruck, you know, even as an older man, I was just like, I love your drumming style, you know.
Incredible drummer.
Yeah. And actually a great writer, you know, just as well. I think, you know, kind of, I didn't realize how many, contributions he made, you know, when I was younger to that band. And I love everyone in that band, they're great. But he was such a nice guy as well, which is always, you know, a massive you know, kind of thrill when you meet someone. They're just totally cool, and he really was.
I went to this gig once, and it was like they used to do them, I think something to do with Gary Crowley at the time, and they used to put them on. And you'd go and, like, I think the tickets were like £8, and you would see like Pop Will Eat Itself, Carter, and someone else all on the same bill. It was just ridiculous, and it felt at the time like they were going on every week. And we went to one of them one night, and I can't think who it was we went to see. I think it may even have been Suede. And this is like very early 90s, and the first band on were the Jennifers.
Wicked.
And they've come out, and knowing you just think, I felt like a kid, but then I saw them walk out, and it must have been, I don't know if the Jennifers was all three members of Supergrass, but I think it was just two, but they literally looked like they'd just popped out in their school lunch break to play. It was, but it was just, they were a fucking incredible band, and I've not got to see them yet because, you know, I think in the middle of all of their kind of comeback stuff, it's all kind of obviously gone out the window at the moment due to the situation we're in.
Yeah, that totally sucks. They deserve their big moment. Yeah. It seemed like they were about to have it. But back to the Jennifers, more importantly. my very good friend, I don't have many friends that run labels at all, but I am friends, and I've been for about 10 years with Saul Galpern, who ran Nude Records in the 90s. And we've just become, you know, really good friends. And he put the Jennifers record out.
Oh, really? Oh, that probably was Suede that they were playing with then.
Right, yeah. And he, you know, of course, he was just like, oh, God, I should have totally liked something. But he did say to me that, you know, Saul's a real music fan and stuff, and I would imagine that this is the gospel truth. He said to me, you guys just need to listen to The Clash and T-Rex, or Bowie, rather. And I think they took his advice, and then they came up with all those absolute bangers off the first album. And I think by that time, Saul was just like, oh no, perhaps I should have, like, you know, agreed to do the album first. But yeah, I don't think Mickey was in the band then. But
yeah, yeah,
But yeah, I think, you know, every musician in that band, although very kind of unorthodox in the way they do things, I just think, you know, they're a great band, they're great songwriters, and they're good fun, you know.
Totally. Well, just going back to school briefly, Luke, did you enjoy it?
Did I enjoy school?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a bad time at school, but I was excellent and abysmal in equal measure at different different things. So it was confusing because I thought maybe I was stupid, but you know, I had a aptitude for kind of English and maths and music and art, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, if you're going to pursue a creative life, there's some good ones to have in your back pocket there.
Yeah, I just remember in my French oral exams, they asked me in French, where are you going on holiday? And I said, Espanol, I think. And they said, how are you going to get there? And I just was searching my mind for a mode of transport I could remember. And I think I said velo, you know, or bike, you know, I was going to go to Spain on my bike. But you know, the first few years were tricky because I was a comic book geek and still am. But I hadn't really discovered music, and I was a swimmer, and I was swimming for Essex. So I was kind of double geek, you know, which was kind of like, you know, not in team sports, on my own, every weekend doing galas, which was really good for me, actually, because I am quite an introvert, and it made me rise to the moment every weekend. I found it quite stressful at the time, but I think in later life it stood me in good stead for being able to perform on stage. I never really get nervous, so in that was kind of cool, but difficult to, you know, mix, I suppose, because I wouldn't be around at the weekend to do play football over the park or something like that. So that was going on. But then at the same time, you know, kind of I was like sneaking into comic book shops after school and kind of just like I do it, and then drifting away into, you know, other worlds, reading them at night and not really doing my homework. So there was that for a few years. And then I met Leon, who I later formed a band with, who's one of my best friends at school. And we were just mad for music, you know, and we just started with he kind of kindly copied me like an Oasis album and a Nirvana album on cassette, and he drew the picture for me, and I've still got it. It's, you know, it's like, and he passed over to me and he showed me how to play a power chord in maths just by showing me, like, just with his hand, and you know, lent me his Metal Zone pedal, and we kind of, and then from about sort of year nine, we were just full on into music. And then kind of the weirder we got, the more popular we got, which was the absolute strangest thing ever. And I never knew how to take that either. So I was lost when I was ignored, and I was lost when I was admired. So make of that what you will. So school was weird. I think I really found my place in the world a little bit later, maybe when I was about 18.
Did you want to be a musician when you was at school?
I think, you know, maybe at that time, looking at the bands that we were into, they were massive, you know, and it certainly had a appeal to it, you know, quit school, join a band, become, you know, a free spirit with enough money to survive and not have to get a real job. That felt good. But my dad was an art teacher and a freelance illustrator, and he had me very young, so he had to kind of lean on the teaching more and more as we sort of got older. And so he was really supportive with all my creative endeavors. And I would draw when I was into comics. I'd draw all the time, you know. So I had the creative impulse from about four. I won like a competition to draw an E.T., a picture of E.T. And they put my picture on a T-shirt. And then a little bit after that, I drew a logo, which was later used by my school for the school. And so they had these kind of little hints that I might be okay at that sort of thing and not other things, masses of other things. But I think kind of school on the whole, it was an exciting time to be young, and I think I did want to be a musician, but I never really got the courage to pursue it in a really, really serious way until I was 16, and then I really, it's a couple of things happened to me, and then I kind of locked in, you know.
Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through. And you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. You said that you was quite introverted, and I mean, I should say for the listeners at home, this isn't the first time we've met. We've known each other probably, I would say, 15, 20 years, I guess.
Yeah. We had friends in common, right?
We did. Yeah. And I mean, it is quite strange because I saw your band with Leon, mm-hmm. And Dave called Smothy. That's the first time I saw you perform.
Yeah.
Introvert and shy were not words that I would definitely say come across when you stood on stage in front of a mm-hmm. microphone. Confidence, and definitely it come across you had something to say.
Sure. It's hard to explain, really, man. I mean, I've seen that in a lot of performers that I've been on tour with and stuff. But, you know, I think it's just like someone puts the kettle on when you're like the kettle in your head. I mean, they put it on when you're about 13. And if the steam doesn't start coming out, it just gets more and more intense in there. And, you know, school wasn't the right platform for me to kind of take my shirt off and smash the place up. Yes. So I don't know, you know, I'm a big fan of performance, and it is performance. And
what do you like about that? Do you like the attention?
It's not the attention. It's that, like, I understand now I meditate and I still perform and still write, and I can see what's going on in my brain a little bit more clearly now. What was going on at that time was I needed to just like scream and then just have endorphins in my brain.
Yeah.
And, you know, the release and then the moment of calm after a gig was just total clear headedness, just totally empty. And I loved that feeling, and it was total escapism while you were doing it. So if I went out my way to not be me, although it was coming from a sincere place to perform and entertain, and I really worked on the music, and I always have worked hard on my music, but it certainly wasn't for attention. I find attention quite difficult to deal with, to be honest, and that's why I've always preferred to be in bands where I'm among friends and stuff, you know, like, you know, I love being in a band with Mike because he knows how to deal with attention, you know. Yeah. And he's at ease with it. But there are aspects of it which it's always nice if someone enjoys what you do. Absolutely. Sure. But yeah, like there's a definitely a need to just like let go massively.
Yeah.
For me. And when I do, there's no edges to it. But in my day to day life, I'm a quite sensitive person, I would say. You know, so.
Yeah. I mean, for listeners that are wondering, Luke's got his shirt off and he's painted gold at the moment.
I didn't want to give you snow blindness. Although it's so dark and dingy in this room, I don't even know if you'd be able to see my puny little chest.
And you mentioned Mike earlier, who plays bass in your band. And Mike's also been a guest on the podcast, so you can listen to that as well, which gives you an insight into Mike's career that for many years kind of was parallel alongside yours, and then you've come together and we'll obviously get onto the label as well as the bands.
There's so much I could say about Mike. I owe him everything, really.
He's one of my favourite human beings.
There's not many like that out there. Like,
well, there's two. He's got a twin. You're lucky.
Jim is absolutely, absolutely amazing. I've just not had the good fortune to spend as much time, because me and Mike work together and we do the label together and we play in two bands together, and so we talk for hours on every day, you know. So I've just, you know. And also, I think maybe when we, I don't know if this is the right time to even speak about this kind of stuff, but, you know, just at the time that we started working together, we couldn't have been more on our ass.
Yeah.
So it was back to, you know, being 15 or 16 again, and just finding the purity and just, you know, just wanting the endorphin release, just wanting the creative. All that stuff, it was so far from getting attention, was so far from our radar at that point. It was just love of the art, you know what I mean? Yeah. Big time, man. But then, and it's taught me that that's the most important, that's the nucleus of everything that matters.
Okay.
Just loving it, you know.
Well, let's trace it back to where some of this could have begun. What was the first record you bought from a record store, Luke?
First record I bought from a record store. Okay. This is. I was being parented as I bought it, and I was certainly being manipulated, but I'm glad for it, because my dad was very young, as I said, you know, so he had cool taste in music, actually, and I owe a lot to him. What he would growing up, he was massively into hip hop and punk, but not just that, you know, he's bought a few crap records as well. But I remember him showing me this like Leonard Cohen record from the 80s, and I was like, this is Leonard Cohen, this is awful, you know, like,
yeah.
And then I heard all his great stuff years later, but no, he was a big hip hop fan, and I loved those hip hop sleeves, those LPs. They look so amazing, and one in particular, I always wanted my own copy of it, and it was 3 Feet High and Rising by De La Soul, and to me, that record is just one of the absolute greats. But it started by getting a single, which was Say No, going hunting that down long after it had come out. And I still love the whole album, but that song, I think it fuses the fun of something like Supergrass, that sort of appeal for me on a musical level. I mean, they've got nothing in common with each other, but in a weird kind of way that De La Soul are a great fusion of like really insightful, intelligent, and quite important lyrics, but they're a fun band at the same time. So it's just that combination really draws me in, you know. The whole world of De La Soul drew me in. I mean, you know, the De La Soul Is Dead record is great too, but Say No Go, you know, the anti-drug message in that song, and but not making it totally overt, and then, you know, the great kind of, all these kind of great hooks and things like that. I think it taught me more about hooks than the Beatles did, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's not to say one is not better than the other. It's just, you know, that's the era. That's what was being played in my house when I was growing up. And I love little musical snatches like that. They're all over that record.
Every single track's got an interlude in between it, and it is cartoony in places, and for someone, you know, I was I was 17 when that came out, and for someone that was very much excited by hip hop, and when you look at the stuff that you was exposed to, you know, like Rakim and Public Enemy and stuff like that, it was, you know, LL Cool J, it was all very hard, aggressive, angry hip hop. And then all of a sudden you've got this album that triggered the whole Daisy Age scene of Tribe, Jungle Brothers, Money Love, Queen Latifah. It all kind of boomed from just the exposure that album got. And that album, unfortunately, those that want to listen to Luke's playlist on the Spotify playlist that comes with this, you're not going to get your De La Soul on Spotify, because I don't think they ever got any kind of clearance on any of the stuff that they put on that album. There was so many samples. And but if you get a chance to ever grab a copy from a record shop, just do it, because that album, it's so fucking punk as well. It's so lo-fi. There's a reason I think why so many people, you know, will put their hand up and say, you know, that's one of the most important records in hip hop.
Oh, man. Prince Paul, you know, mega. I mean, how old were De La Soul when they made that? Like 18, 19 years old. And then you've got like, you know, there's like, you know, John Bonham drum parts mixed with like Otis Redding whistling. And, you know, I never heard the original records that any of those things came from. So it was like a psychedelic, you know, kind of time portal through music, you know, from the last 30, 40 years before it. And, you know, it turned me on to Tribe. I mean, Low End Theory is one of my favorite albums. And, you know, and the lo-fi element, I still, you know, things like Kid Koala and you know, DJ Shadow, things that I got into later in life. I think that little bit of homemadeness to 3 Feet High and Rising, I still need a bit of that in any of the music that I listen to. I think it just... Something very charming about the whole thing, and
definitely,
yeah, waxing lyrical. Sorry,
we can always wax lyrical about De La Soul, Luke.
Of course, man. Cool.
Did you get to see? Did you come to the Toothbrush when we had Maceo?
What year would that have been?
Oh, 2001, maybe.
I don't know. I think. Because I used to work at the Sunrooms, and so I was kind of normally in between tours, even as he's 18-year-old or whatever. It's like, yeah, I was always there. I've never seen them live. I would love to see them live. But having said that, actually, you know, I did get a great musical education at the Sunrooms. You know, they always had great hip hop nights, and they would play all that great stuff, you know, all the time. And it would kind of, it was like it had been released, you know, that year. It was like being kept alive in that bar anyway, in Southend, which was kind of for listeners that don't know Southend too well, it was also called the Scum Rooms on the side. So I fit in perfectly.
Do you know what? I have one of the best experiences of my life in there. And to give some sort of context to it, it was the venue was like a sort of little two-story sort of bar, and it was very bohemian. When you worked there, it was very bohemian in its decor. And then upstairs, like, anyway, I remember being up there one night, and there was this band on playing upstairs, and I looked over in the corner was a guy with a spoon and a lighter burning stuff. And I was like, fuck, it's pretty liberal in here. And I remember going over and going like, what's that, dude? And he went, absinthe. And I was like, wicked. And I went, they sell that here. And he went, yeah. And this was like before you could buy absinthe anywhere. It was this new thing. And it was like, yeah, it's made from like the root of wormwood. It's like, yes, yeah, it's a hallucinogen. So I was like, right. So I remember just going and buying a load of it and just sitting there and burning a spoon. It must have looked fucking insane. And drunk a shed load of absinthe. And I remember going up to this band afterwards just going like, fucking hell, man. That's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And they were like, thanks, man. I was like, look, I'm going to put you on at the Toothbrush. I don't mean it in a horrible way at all, but I can't even remember what they were called, but I booked them to come and play at the Toothbrush like the following month. And I was like, man, I can't wait to see this band again. They fucking destroyed my mind. It was fucking shocking, Luke. Awful. But I think I'd probably had about half a pint of absinthe. And I was like, I've seen the future. It's this four-piece in some rooms.
Oh, mate. I could tell you some stories. But yeah, man, I mean, that place was great in some respects. And in other 100%. Respects... Other respects, it was deeply, stressful to work there. Yeah. But I'm still friends with people that I met there, and actually some types of music that I'd never been exposed to. Like there were like dub sound systems coming in, I knew dub, but I didn't really know it. And then like watching a sound system set up and do a whole night, and watching the crowd react to it, that was, that was powerful. And you know, I couldn't ever connect with house music in my formative years. And then I saw like this one house night and I was kind of working on a bar and I was like counting bars. Oh yeah, like things keep changing X amount of bars and then something drops out and I kind of understood it. And I think, I might have learned more from working at the Sun Rooms than like I did at school. You know, sure. It was, and I definitely, I left wiser and slightly more haggard.
Yeah. Well, this is a very fitting conversation to be having as we lead into track five, Luke, which is the song that soundtracked your years in Clubland.
Oh, crikey. Never been much of a clubber, I have to admit. I would only go out in a desperate pursuit of, female affection, which was not forthcoming most of the time. So what would happen is you'd make really poor choices about where to go and end up in the basically like London's equivalent of of the Sun Rooms. And, around, I remember I came back from a festival and I don't know what year it would have been, but I'd really been looking forward to a record. I think it was a second Elastica record was on the cards. And I was like, I really had appreciated that first record and got into it. And it came out and it just did nothing for me. And I was really depressed about it.
So have you gone back to it?
I haven't, but I have no idea if it stands up or if it doesn't. But the important thing was I was like, I just need to get out of this rut and just listen to something else. So I just I went to the record shop, gave that back. Sorry, Elastica, I really do like really like them. I'll buy it again one day, I promise. But then I was just like, right, bollocks. And I just got like a Mudhoney Best Of and Go Plastic by Squarepusher. And then that just... But it literally took my head off. I was like, what?
I mean, that's an intense evening right there.
Oh, man. I fell asleep to it one night and I swear to God, I injured my brain. Like, right at the end of that album, it just sounds like a digital walrus just mooing, into oblivion. But what a mega talent that guy is, man. Like, yeah. And that record's just kicks ass. And I don't know, they sent me on a big Warp Records thing for many years, and then one of my friends started working for Warp, and he would just like give me records. They would just let him take whatever he wants, so he just let me take stuff and I'd just borrow it, listen to it for a week or something, and then take it back. And so that was really exciting, and that was just before I got things would start to work, was starting to work with music. So I was kind of there was a bit of a division between what I was writing and performing and what I was enjoying. But I've always been real, like, flirting around with any kind of genre. I don't really have any edges on anything in that respect. And I think that just comes from, like, being raised by, like, my dad, who's, like, really into, he's a painter. And, just I could see the merit in a photographically perfect incarnation of, a fruit bowl painted, or, the snail, or, something really abstract. So I think that's just crept into my music taste as I've got older.
It's the best place to be, mate. There shouldn't be any edges. Track six, Luke, a favourite song from an artist from your home county.
Oh, wow, yeah. This was a fun question to answer. There's loads of good stuff. I mean, obviously, being all interwoven, doing a label and stuff, you get to hear so much cool stuff, that gets sent to you or you come across or people suggest. But I really, really loved the Horseheads, and it was just such a random set of circumstances that led to us working together. And I swear to you, I've not put this as a choice because we released the record. Genuinely, I love this band, and I would love them even if they hated me and they didn't want to talk to me. the Horseheads Castles, what a tune! And what
Luke, if I had to do this, I'm not joking. That track would be in my final three, without a shadow of a doubt.
Oh, amazing, like, man.
I'm bearing in mind how much I adore Depeche Mode, like, and so many other bands. Like, but that track, I mean, I'll let you talk about it, but it's fucking incredible.
Man, they are one of those bands where I don't know why it works. Mike did a session where he went into the studio to help him put a song together, and he just was like, I've just made it worse. You know, like, you know, they just have this kind of weird, it's like almost Stooges-esque thing where when they do what they do with those people, it comes out and it just sounds like full of life, full of energy and rebellion. It's Discord Records is in there, you know, but then also like Factory Records is in there, Creation Records is in there. It's you know, there's Bad Brains, but there's also kind of like, you know, it's something else, you know. It's got a lot of the DNA from other things that I like, but they sound like no one else. And we only really got to meet them, but actually I was working with another kid, who's a really nice guy, who was doing a project called Freak, and we were doing a little bit of experimenting, writing together and stuff. And I went to see him play, and they were supporting. And every time I see the whole set, someone new's in the band. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and then sometimes they all swap instruments, and then other times, like we saw one time, like the bass player was just drinking a bottle of wine. You know, that's all, and they had no shoes on. Do you know what I mean? It's just complete and utter chaos and disorder, and it was just it's just welcome in my world. It reminded me, you know, maybe of some things in the past. But Ronnie is, you know, I was speaking to him earlier, he's just one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, you know. It's super cool, super lovely, so funny. And again, just like kind of what you see on stage is not normally what you get when you talk, I suppose. And we've been working with them for a good few years now, and we're really looking forward to doing a record of them, a whole album.
I went back and watched the... Sorry, go on, carry on.
No. They just make me smile, man. And I think, you know, that can't be a bad thing.
I went back and watched the video again today. Did Canna make that video?
Canna did. And do you know what? There's a good story behind that. we did it in a rush, right? So when I say we, we had a gig like on this Friday, and I think I met him in a pub on the Thursday, and I had to borrow a lighting pack off of someone to lend them to make the video. They went and made the video. Canna smashed it. You know, they smashed it. But I don't think they turned the lights off. And then the next day, someone else had to go to the studio that was playing at this gig we were doing, and they touched the cymbal, and it was like magma. Like, oh God! Like, and it's just like, but so the video, as great as it was, it really was as chaotic in the real world, you know, as it looks in the video. But Can's great when he just he's great always, but he's super great when he's. When he's allowed to just be free with it, you know, and there's no rules. I don't know what he was planning to do. He didn't even tell me. Just went and did it, and then it was done. I think he edited it. Like, it was all done in like 24 hours. It looks great still, doesn't it?
Does look brilliant. And that song, it's like, I mean, it's going to be on the playlist that accompanies this podcast. And for me, I have these moments where every now and again you get a song that just stops you. Like when you first heard The Rat by The Walkman, where you just like, fuck, what's this?
Watch
like,
it.
Who's this band? What is this? And I think the first time I saw it was, you probably shared it on your social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always kind of sort of kept an eye on obviously what everybody's doing, you know, in our neck of the woods in bands and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then just the screams he does before the guitars come back in are just fucking perfect. Like, so it's like, it's goosebumps right there, Luke.
Like, it's real. It's real, isn't it? It's as real as it gets, that scream, you know, like, I just can't even do it. I couldn't do it justice in a million years. Ronnie's got it, man. We were talking at one time about him doing some hip hop or something, because he's just got such a way with words. But in a kind of bizarre tentacle of that story is we a couple of years later we did a tune with them called Questions, and you know, everybody's always after the old Spotify playlists, you know, get those stats up, you know, on the tracks and what have you, and. And I woke up one morning and our distribution just sent us this link and they're like, yo, you're on this, you know, Hall Says Tunes on this Spotify player. So I was like, wicked. And I like checked it out and it was like all Christian music. It's like, be fucking be what I want. You know, there's all swearing in the tune and stuff. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, how? And I still don't know, but someone must have got it, made a serious mistake. And this it was only on there for like 1 week. I bet people were like, ah, you know. But it was like the Christian choices that week. And it's like, man, you know, out of all the bands you could have picked.
Wonderful.
You pick the band putting two grubby middle fingers up at the whole world, you know.
Oh, I love it. Okay. Track 7. Well, no, before we get to the last track, I just wanted to, while we're talking about the home county. So
sure.
Watching you and Mike and you know, and Canna and so many people that have come through the doors of the club that I've been at for a long time, you know, and as far out as it goes from, like, you know, I've seen your sister come to the club for many, many years. She's married someone that I watched come through my club and still to this day played the best gig I've ever seen on that stage. And smashed the whole place up and ruined it for everybody afterwards. But it was the most fucking amazing thing I've ever seen. Was that being, you know, finding yourself surrounded by what was going on in Southend, you know, aside from all the bands that you know, the people that you've, you know, worked with, you know, there's been so much other stuff, whether that be Sam Duckworth, whether that be Horrors, these New Puritans, Ipso Facto, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, was it being surrounded by so much kind of exciting stuff in an area where I set this podcast up for one reason, was to find out, and I initially wanted to do it all based in Essex, about that desire and that expectation, not desire, expectation that artists should move to London. Mm-hmm. And I find that crazy. I've worked for many, many years with Scroobius Pip, and he's somebody that's always said, I quite like Stamford. I don't really want to move to London. And there is always that surprise when people go, oh, do you live in London? No. And I've gone a long way around getting to this question, Luke, but was it the fact that you were surrounded by so much talent and it, where you live that you thought, right, I'm going to try and put a label together?
It was a series of things, really. So I did a band very young, as you know, and we got to put a record out, and then it all came to an end, and I didn't know any other musicians, really. And it was, you know, around the time that the Horrors emerged and bands like that, and I'd been in a band with Reese at secondary school, and the guys from These New Puritans would come to a club night that me and Canna used to run at the Sun Rooms called Mishmash, which was like a grime, you know, punk rock hybrid night kind of thing, which was fun at the time. And I would see these people about, but then just after that, I started playing with a double bass player in London to do a project for quite some time. And that's how I met my drummer now, Henry, who's in Asylums. But I lived in a little sex shop for 7 years, not in the shop, but above it.
That would be quite weird.
One of my family members was involved with it. I don't know what his involvement was with it, but he had a cheap flat going. And so I could live quite cheaply there, and I just used to commute to London and do these. I did like tons of stuff up there with this other project. And what I found was that I didn't find it as stimulating in London as I found it at home. And I never went there to be more stimulated, if that makes sense. But you expect that, okay, you know, like if you move to New York and you're from the sticks, you'd be like, wow, the big city, you know, things going on. But I found it kind of, I love London, but I found it all very disconnected and considered and stuff like that. And then as that period of my life was coming to an end, I was just had this massive urge to do what I could to do something positive in my hometown. And I'd been teaching music business and songwriting for quite some time in the town and seen all these great kids making music, and it just changed who I was as a person that whole time. And it made me want to dedicate my life to the arts, whether it is stuff that I'm involved in, other people's stuff, or just mentoring or help, or just helping young people, just to maybe avoid some of the pitfalls that I'd fallen into, or friends of mine had fallen into. Try and get a good working methodology to their art, and try and make it positive in a mental health capacity, and just fun and community and all that stuff. It wasn't easy at first. We started from zero, you know, and you know, very small events. We only had a few acts on the label, and we had virtually no money. But to I raised your long round way to get to your question with a long way round to get to your answer is, I didn't know that that's what I wanted to do, but I know now that it was a desire to bring some positivity into some people's experience with music by just helping them make it that bit easier to put stuff out, and to have like some friends around them that were looking after them for the right reasons. You know, we would have had to be insane to get into it at that point in time to make money. It was never, and it will never be about that. It's just about trying to get people where they need to be just a little bit quicker than maybe they otherwise would have. And if we can do that, then it just makes me feel happy, man, just to be able to have helped in a small capacity, you know.
I mean, before we go to the last question, I don't think we've even said what the label's called yet.
Our label is called Cool Thing Records, and we also have a radio show called Cool Thing Presents on Soho Radio.
So I've seen this, and is it available as a podcast as well?
No, we haven't ventured into that. I think there's just a few too many plates spinning at this point in time.
And so people, you know, can go and listen to it on Soho Radio now, though, on the website.
It's on Mixcloud, but our show airs every other Wednesday at 12.
Okay. So you had a former guest of this podcast on. You had the lovely Gail Porter.
Oh, yeah. She's a lovely human being. I don't know how we've become friends, but we... I don't know. She's been, like, literally... I couldn't do it justice. She gave me a guitar, you know, like... I don't know. She helped us carry our gear, bought us cupcakes at gigs. I don't know. She's just a one-off, man. And like, I don't know. We're quite welcoming, you know, like, Gail's lovely. And then she's a true friend though. Like it's not like some surface thing. It's like, we talk about art and all sorts of things. And, you know, if she's having a bad day, you know, we check in, and if, you know, vice versa.
She's a wonderful human being. She really is.
Oh yeah, great ambassador for you know, kind of looking after your mental health.
Completely, completely. And for anybody that's not yet watched the documentary that Gail made, that's on the BBC iPlayer, go and watch it, because it's honest. It's brutally honest, and insightful and inspiring. And yeah, and it's made for the right reasons by a wonderful person. So go and check that out. Last track, Luke. You can play DJ now, mate.
Oh, yikes.
The song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
Oh, it's Observatory Crest by Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. And it's just, for me... It doesn't really have a lot in common with what people know him for, if I'm honest. I know all of his great records, you know, Safe's Milk and, you know, all the other, you know, kind of Trout Mask, what have you. But this one, I think it sounds like it could have been sampled by De La Soul. You know, it's got a wonderful kick drum, snare groove with a great bass line, but there's something going on in it. And, it just appealed. I think something in the lyric as well about, you know, I don't know. I get like a mental imagery when I listen to music, as I'm sure most people do. And whenever I hear it, I just remember like in Benfleet, there was this like big hill. I can't remember what it was called, but my friend Ed used to live at the top of this big hill.
And Bread and Cheese Hill.
Bread and Cheese Hill, yeah. I'm thinking of Essex Way, which is
right.
Got a little bit more grass and what have you. And anyway, around the time that I first heard this tune, we stayed up all night and just, you know, slept on the top of this big hill and just had a few beers and just talked about life and stuff. And it just reminds me of just those, just nothing, you know, kind of, there's no objective, no, nothing, just nothing really out of the ordinary going on. But sometimes those moments are like the ones that stay with you forever, because you feel something on some other level that stays with you. And I just connect whenever I hear that song. It just connects me to that sort of feeling of like just total like wonder of just being young and not knowing what's going to happen in your life and what could be. And maybe I'll be in a band, maybe we'll get to do this, maybe we'll get to do that. And then, like, you know, some of it happens, you know, and some of it doesn't.
Well, a lot of it has. And to finish up, obviously where we've got to now is there's a new Asylums record, right?
There is. It's called Genetic Cabaret, and it's out on the 17th of July.
A delicious-looking bit of vinyl as well.
They turned up at my office last week, and I was petrified that something would have gone wrong with them. We proofread it, like, obsessively over and over again. I was like, the tunes are going to be in the wrong order. Everything's going to go wrong. And then it just turned up, and it was just riot. And I'm so proud of it. Crudely designed... like my dad's he's a designer, like does all of our sleeves and stuff. And but I always like kind of give him something that I'm trying to, like, I give him an image, and I crudely had taped like all of the kind of imagery that I wanted him to kind of create together the day before we left to go to America to record. And and when it turned up now, I was just like, oh wow, it looks so good. So I was kind of proud of him, I was proud of the band, and just proud that we've managed to make it to a third record in extremely difficult times. Do you know Absolutely. What I mean? On our own label, you know what I mean? And I never, it's more than I ever expected, you know? So, yeah, it was a great feeling.
Luke, it's been a pleasure talking to you tonight, and it's been a pleasure watching your career happen as well, you know, and it involving lots of people that I have a lot of time for as well. It's been really, really nice to watch it all unfold and come to fruition, man. It's yeah, it's great, man.
Well, thanks for all the things that you did along the way, man. No, seriously, dude, you know, respect is mutual. I remember back in my youth, I think you would turn us on to cool records and stuff, and just, you know, be a voice of hope.
Well, this is your own work. Go and listen to that second Elastica album again. Go revisit it.
Is it really worth a go? Because I wasn't trying to be bitchy or anything, because I loved that first record.
I know. It was so different.
I saw them around that time. They had a different lineup, right? And
yeah. Well, they had Mew joined on keys then, and, right. And Mew's now married to Justin, the drummer. Who's a wonderful human being, and also if you want to get an insight into what it was like touring with Elastica then, have you seen the MIA documentary?
I watched about the first 15 minutes of it, and I plan to watch the rest of it. It was just before, I think, literally, I'm not joking, I'm pretty sure my wife went into labor, so I was just killing time watching documentaries. we were a week overdue, and I was like, all right, okay, so I just go through the next documentary, and I think I just remember, like, I'm pretty sure it was that night. It's like, I think my waters are broken. And I was like, okay, turn that off, right? Try and find the bags. And I can't drive as well. So I was like trying to get a cab. And
brilliant.
And
brilliant.
It was so stressful that I've not gone back yet, but I need to go back.
It's really mad. She made some of their videos when she was like 16, 17, and went on tour with them. And she's kept every bit of, like, sort of video camera footage of all of these moments. It's something to behold, that doc.
Definitely. I'll have to dive in there, because that first record, well, all of her records, but particularly that first record, it did it for me in such a huge way. Like, Galang is a co-write with Justine as well, isn't it? And Sun Showers, man, tunes like that, they're just mega tunes, and it's got that little bit of that De La Soul lo-fi-ness to it. It's sweet.
Wonderful. Luke, I will let you get back to your lovely family, man. Thanks so much for giving up your time today. Best of luck with the record, and we'll put links to the Cool Thing website on everything we do when this comes out, man.
You lovely man, thank you.
Take it easy, dude.
Take it easy, buddy.
There you go. It's always really nice when you know someone, and I say, you know, I know Luke really well. I guess I feel like I know him better because I've watched his career for so many years flourish. And so that's been really nice to just have that opportunity for us to sit down and have a chinwag about it all. And I hope you got as much joy from listening to that as I did talking to Luke. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, as mentioned at the beginning, feel free to go and have a route around in the archives of this podcast, because there's 150 plus episodes with some incredible creative people. So go and have a rummage over there. And if you really enjoy it and you want to support the podcast and you want more content, then I do have a Patreon page, which is patreon.com/offthebeatentrackpodcast. You can find out about it all at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Right, I'll let you get on with your day. See you soon. Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.